Hello, and welcome to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Tuesday, March 19th, 2024. I'm your reader, Denise. On the front page, the Iowa GOP passes second day EA proposal. Plan moves forward as Coalition of School Leaders voice opposition by Aaron Murphy, Gazette, Des Moines Bureau. State House Republicans have approved two different proposals to overhaul the operation and funding of Iowa's 9 area education agencies, which provide special education services and other supports to K-12 schools. A coalition of school superintendents recently expressed opposition to both plans. Iowa Senate Republicans passed their version of AEA changes Monday at the Iowa Capitol. This proposal is similar to one presented by Governor Kim Reynolds earlier this year, but significantly different from one that Iowa House Republicans passed last month. Superintendents, we are deeply concerned about the proposed changes. Last weekend, a group of 32 K-12 Iowa superintendents made their feelings on both proposals clear when they emailed all state legislators to express their opposition to the plan. Our message is clear. We are deeply concerned about the proposed changes to the AEAs, especially the shift towards fee-for-service approach, states the emailed letter from the superintendents who oppose the plans. The value of the AEA system as designed is that it is a cooperative that ensures that every school district, regardless of size or location, has access to the services it needs to serve students, the letter continues. Rural school districts in particular rely heavily on AEAs for critical support. Disrupting a model that has largely worked over the past 50 years will have grave consequences for the students we serve. A much smaller group of superintendents has publicly supported the various AEA proposals, among them the leaders of the Okoboji, Spirit Lake, and Council Bluffs school districts. Both bills would create new division for AEA oversight. Currently, state and federal funding is sent directly to the area education agencies, which provide services to school districts in their region. The AEAs are most prominently used in supporting special education students, those who have an individualized education plan, or IEP. AEAs also provide professional development for teachers, crisis response programs, and media services, among others. Under the Senate's bill, which is much closer aligned to Reynolds' proposal, AEA funding would be transitioned to a fee-for-service model through which AEAs would provide special education and other services only if requested by a school district. That annual uncertainty, critics of the proposal say, would jeopardize the entire AEA system. Both proposals create a new AEA oversight division in the Iowa Department of Education. The House version keeps the current funding structure largely in place. State funding for special education services would go to the school districts, and they would be required to use that funding with the AEAs. 6 GOP senators joined Democrats in opposing the bill. Senate Republicans approved their proposal, an amended version of Senate File 2386, on Monday. Only Republicans voted in favor of the bill, while 6 Senate Republicans joined all Democrats in voting against it. Senators Waylon Brown, Mike Klimisch, Mark Lofgren, Charlie McClintock, Sandy Salmon, and Jeff Taylor. During Senate debate, Senator Lynn Evans, a Republican from Orillia and former teacher, principal, and superintendent, said the changes are needed because the U.S. Department of Education has since 2018 categorized Iowa as needs assistance under the Federal Individuals with Disabilities Education Act. This bill is about ensuring that our children with disabilities receive the best possible services in education. The goal is to get the best return on investment for the delivery of special education services to the kids who need them, Evans said. This is the right direction to go. We need more local control on how these dollars are spent. Senate Democrats proposed pausing the AEA reforms and establishing a task force to spend a year studying the agency's and making recommendations to lawmakers before next year's legislative session. They criticized Republicans for not listening to the outpouring of educators and parents who have expressed opposition to the AEA proposals and the process by which the legislation has been proposed and passed. Democrats pointed to a recent Des Moines Register MediaCom Iowa poll, which showed 56% of Iowans have a favorable view of the AEAs. State House Republicans have once again maybe listened, but they did not hear their constituents. Because if they heard their constituents in Iowa, they told them resoundingly to not do anything to this AEA system, Senator Molly Donahue, a Democrat from Cedar Rapids who has worked for 43 years as a special education teacher, said during the debate. Donahue said she has benefited from AEA services as a special education teacher and as a child when she spoke with a lisp. The fact is, I wouldn't be standing here talking to anybody at all had I not had those services, Donahue said. Reynolds has said the AEA system needs updating and has claimed that Iowa's special education students are falling behind other states, and although the test scores she has used as an example are also used by the federal government, the company that designs the test has said the scores should not be used to inform policy change. Reynolds' administration hired a consultant to review the AEA system and recommend changes, a process that Democrats roundly criticized as biased. I want to thank the Senate for their commitment to improving special education and acknowledging that the AEA system needs reform, Reynolds said in a statement. I now look forward to working with the House and Senate to reach a compromise that will bring transparency, accountability, and consistency to the AEA system, while most importantly improving outcomes for students with disabilities. Under the Senate bill, starting in the 2025-2026 school year, 90% of the funding for special education would go directly to the school districts, which would be free to use that funding to contract for special education services through an AEA or a private company. The remaining 10% would go to the AEAs. Also under the Senate bill, in the 2024-2025 school year, 60% of the funds for media and educational services would go directly to the school districts, which again could use those funds to contract with the AEA or a private company. The remaining 40% would go to the AEAs. Starting in the 2025-2026 school year, all media and educational services funding would remain with school districts and none of it would go to the AEAs. Bill would also address teacher pay. The Senate bill also proposes raising the minimum salary for new Iowa teachers to $46,251, which they say is the current statewide average for starting teachers' salaries. House Republicans addressed teacher and other educational staff salaries in a separate bill, and they proposed raising the starting teacher minimum to $50,000, matching the figure proposed by Reynolds, phased in over 2 years. House Republicans also proposed dedicating more funding to help schools increase veteran teacher salaries and create a $15 per hour minimum wage for educational support staff. In her statement, Reynolds calls for legislation that will increase salaries for both starting and veteran teachers. What's next for the bill? House Republicans passed their AEA bill, House File 2612, on February 29th with a 53-41 vote. Only Republicans support the bill, and 9 Republicans joined all Democrats in voting against it. With both Republican-led chambers having approved their respective AEA bills, leaders from each chamber and Reynolds will need to reach an agreement on a proposal that can pass both chambers and be signed into law by Reynolds. Study: rural Linn County needs 661 more units by 2040. New construction, targeted rehabilitation of older stock needed to meet demand, by Marissa Payne, the Gazette, Cedar Rapids. The first ever assessment of Linn County's housing needs beyond the Cedar Rapids Metro shows smaller, more rural communities within the county need nearly 700 more housing units by 2040 and an investment in rehabilitation initiatives to keep up with population growth. The 14 communities studied, according to a presentation to the Linn County Board of Supervisors Monday, included Alburnett, Center Point, Central City, Coggin, Ely, Fairfax, Robbins, Springville, Walker, Lisbon, Mount Vernon, Palo, Bertram, and Prairieburg. A housing analysis is done annually within the metro, Cedar Rapids, Marion, and Hiawatha. So that's why this study focused on the other Linn County communities. The supervisors in 2022 awarded $70,000 in federal American Rescue Plan Act funds to complete the housing study assessing rural needs and a forthcoming equity analysis. They're very useful for future planning purposes and for securing things like grants and tax credits, Planning and Development Director Charlie Nichol said of housing needs assessments. We've also seen a lot of growth in our smaller communities. We know there's housing challenges, struggles, just some opportunities there as well. The county partnered with the East Central Iowa Council of Governments for the study. ECICOG housing planner Deanna Robinson said three key themes emerged from the assessment. Demographic shifts are affecting what typical households look like as the population grows older and household size shrinks, creating a mismatch in the existing inventory and the types of homes in demand. There is critical need for housing rehabilitation programs, and despite relatively low housing costs, affordability remains an issue for many households because of various community-specific factors, Fairfax Mayor Joanne Beer told the Gazette. Her sense is the city needs more workforce housing that would allow an average family or a young family just starting out to purchase their own home or rent at an affordable rate. Most of Fairfax growth is due to new homes in the Heartland Heights development, Beer said. The 171-lot development has come online in recent years, adding a mix of single and multifamily housing. The logistics park from Travero, the logistics company affiliated with Alliant Energy, operates on a 101-acre site inside Fairfax city limits and within the Big Cedar Industrial Center, and will hopefully attract new jobs, Beer said. That means the city must be able to offer the housing these workers desire so they don't have to live outside of Fairfax, she said. A study of this nature would be very welcome to look at and see if my gut instinct are true, Beer said, of the need for more workforce housing. I think it'll be helpful to us for our smart growth planning in the future. Rural areas need hundreds more units. The study area is projected to grow only slightly from 25,006 in 2025 to 27,762 in 2040, with population growing an estimate of 0.7% a year. The projected number of units needed by 2025 is 10,819, rising to 13,130 by 2040. Factoring in the number of units currently available, the study estimates the gap of additional units needed to rise from 150 in 2025 to 305 in 2030, 489 in 2035, and 661 in 2040. It's very hard to predict what a population will do in a rural community, Robinson said. It would drastically go up or down depending on many factors. ECICOG recommended the proportion of new multifamily rental development be slightly higher than the existing ratios of owner-occupied versus rental units in each municipality. Demographics shaping housing needs. Changes in demographics such as household size becoming smaller and the number of older Iowans growing will influence demand for certain types of housing. Fairfax, Palo, Robbins, and Ely have seen the highest growth in Linn County outside of the metro, approximately doubling their populations from 2000 to 2020. Overall, the study area's population growth is expected to decline in the next 20 years, with the exception of the growing population of Iowans over age 65. There are an estimated 330 independent senior housing units in the study area, falling 164 senior housing units short of anticipated need. Central City, Coggin, Ely, Lisbon, Springville, and Walker already have populations with more than 20% being Iowans aged 65 and over. Those communities should really be focusing resources towards the age group now in preparation for that jump, Robinson said. Home rehabilitation needed. The age of housing stock is the largest indicator of homes in need of rehabilitation, Robinson said, and the age of some houses within Linn County calls for a greater investment in rehabilitation initiatives and energy efficiency upgrades. According to the National Association of Home Builders, Iowa has the oldest housing stock in the Midwest and is among the oldest in the nation. Over 40% of the county's housing stock is more than 50 years old. ECICOG conducted a windshield study, or drive-by assessment, of housing conditions where staff looked at 2,472 housing units to examine their exterior quality and overall condition. One-third, 33%, were in need of major rehabilitation, where the units showed issues such as porches being in disrepair, paint was peeling, or cracks were evident in the foundation, walls, or roof. Communities may focus on targeted rehabilitation programs, Robinson said. She said a senior rehabilitation program could help seniors age in place and make health modifications to their home, such as non-slip flooring or handrails in hazardous areas. With 41% of rental units also over 50 years old, Robinson said rental rehabilitation also could be a priority. In Alburnett, Centerpoint, Central City, Coggin, Lisbon, Mount Vernon, and Walker, anywhere from 12% to 30% of rental households are aged 65 and older, so they should consider the intersection between these two areas, Robinson said. Affordability, a challenge. In the study area, 14% of homeowners and 38% of renters were determined to be cost burdened. The U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development considers a household cost burdened when housing costs exceed 30% of the person's income. This often results in the household's foregoing health care, education, and nutrition, and spending less in the community on goods and services. Over time, Robinson said, job loss, birth of a child, disability, stagnant wages, and inflation may affect a home's affordability. Tools to help communities boost housing. ECICOG looked to develop housing policy tools to address the area's housing needs, creating a housing toolbox with targeted initiatives to reach these goals. Robinson said the organization is looking to promote production, investing in new construction of affordable units and converting unused buildings into housing, preservation, investing in existing homes with a goal of preventing displacement or loss of housing units, and protection, reducing housing insecurity and boosting access. Some of ECICOG's tools are geared towards the county, while others are specific to the 14 communities studied. The report includes one-page community profiles for each city, including an affordability analysis of area homes and opportunities for initiatives to introduce specifically in a certain community. Each of the 14 communities will get copies of the report, and ECICOG will present to some councils, city councils, with the greatest needs, Robinson said. The study also will be posted on the ECICOG website, ecicog.org, and Linn County's website, linncountyiowa.gov. Robinson said the Housing Fund for Linn County will provide some funding and other grant sources, and also can guide how communities use or establish tax increment financing districts to fuel housing development. The assessment's strategic housing goals include preserving existing housing stock, expanding lot supply, boosting senior housing options, increasing missing middle housing, and addressing a lack of capacity and community buy-in for affordable housing. Supervisor Chair Kristen Running Marquardt said this study will help guide some of our work here in Linn County. And also on the front page, how people incarcerated in Iowa prisons access books. Every publication that arrives at a prison is subject to review, by Emily Anderson, The Gazette. Access to books and other publications is crucial for giving incarcerated people a chance at future success, library advocates say. But policies intended to keep prisons secure can restrict the materials available to them, either by controlling which content is allowed or how books must enter facilities. Balancing the need for security with the right prisoners have to freely access information is a difficult task, but one that should involve greater public discussion, according to Sam Helmick, Community and Access Services Coordinator for the Iowa City Public Library and the past president of the Iowa Library Association. It's difficult for me to suggest that any form of literature is safer or unsafer, because that's sort of suggesting that ideas are not neutral until they're applied. But I do think that we would do well to have a more public and transparent discourse on that, so that society and community can arrive at those conclusions, Helmick said. Whether you're a prisoner or a client or an inmate or you're a free public citizen, you have a right to expect access to information as an American. The American Library Association, in its Library Bill of Rights, states that there is a compelling public interest in the preservation of intellectual freedom for people in jails, prisons, and other detention facilities. Information and ideas available outside the prison are essential to people who are incarcerated for a successful transition to freedom, the ALA states on its website. In Iowa, access to books among prisoners comes with rules. Here's how people who are incarcerated access books in prison, which books are allowed, and who decides those restrictions. Prisons allow access to libraries, e-books. All Iowa prisons have a library, but Sarah Finneran, research director for the Iowa Department of Corrections, couldn't provide an estimate of the number or kinds of books available in each library. Depending on an inmate's privileges, they may be able to check out a book and take it back to their cell, but some inmates can only read books in the library. Inmates can request books be ordered for the prison library, but any books ordered for the library must go through a review process. Inmates can also access about 51,000 free e-books from Project Gutenberg if they have a tablet. The tablets must be purchased through the Iowa Prison Industries and cost $150, so not all prisoners have one. Inmates can purchase books through approved vendors. People incarcerated in Iowa prisons can purchase books, but they must use two approved book vendors. In 2021, the Iowa Department of Corrections changed its policy to admit only books purchased from Books and Things Warehouse, Inc. in New Jersey and Hamilton Book, LLC in Connecticut. A DOC spokesperson at the time told Iowa Public Radio the change was being made to prevent contraband from being smuggled into prisons through books. Prisoners can order books themselves, or they can ask a friend or family member to order a book from one of the vendors and have it sent to them. Even then, before a book makes it into an incarcerated person's hands, it must go through a process of review. How do Iowa prisons decide which books to deny? Finneran said books and other publications, including magazines and newspapers, that arrive at Iowa prisons are subject to review. While none are banned, she said, they can be denied for institutional security operations reasons. Each prison has its own procedures for internal review, which must align with 11 rules established by the DOC that govern what is allowed. If prison staff believe the material violates a rule, the publication is sent to a three-person committee for a further review. A book under review is sent to one member of the committee who represents DOC operations. If that person approves the book, it's approved. If they deny the book, it's sent to a second DOC representative on the committee. If the second member agrees with the first person's decision, the book is denied. The third committee member, who DOC policy states should have broad exposure to various publications, is only involved in the process if the first and second committee member disagree. In that case, the third member makes a final decision on the publication. Once a book or other publication has been denied, it remains on the department's list for 5 years, during which time it is automatically denied if it arrives at any Iowa prison. Prison staff and prisoners themselves can appeal if they disagree with the decision to approve or deny a book or other publication. DOC declined to release the names of the three people who currently serve on the publication's review committee. Finneran said the current committee members have been on the committee for various time frames ranging from 8 to 15 years. Which books are allowed in prison? Which have been denied? Many of the books that are sent to the three-person committee are approved. Examples of books that have been reviewed and approved include 50 Shades of Grey by E.L. James and Ted Bundy, Conversations with a Killer by Hugh Ainsworth. The majority of publications that are currently on the DOC's automatic denial list were rejected based on rules that relate to nudity and sexual content, or another rule that relates to topics that could compromise the security of the prison. Examples of books that have been denied include Tears of the Silenced, an Amish true crime memoir of childhood sexual abuse, brutal betrayal, and ultimate survival by Misty Griffin, and How to Jiu-Jitsu for Beginners by Nathan Demetz. What happens when a book is denied? According to DOC policy, after a book is denied, an inmate has 10 days to decide whether to have it destroyed or send it somewhere else with shipping costs charged to the inmate. Inmates, or the person who ordered the book for them, can receive a refund of the original cost of the book if they choose to send it back to the vendor, but the inmate has to pay the cost of return shipping. Access to books in county jails differs. Policies about books in jails vary from county to county in Iowa, but many are less restrictive than state prisons. At the Linn County Jail in Cedar Rapids, Sheriff Brian Gardner said books are not denied based on content, but they do have to come from legitimate retailer. Books and other publications mailed to the Johnson County Jail in Iowa City have to come directly from the publisher or a bookstore as well, and they can be restricted if they have nudity or offensive and graphic material, said Alyssa Schurer, the public information officer for the Johnson County Sheriff's Office. Inmates in the Johnson County Jail can also request up to 5 books from the Iowa City Public Library, and they are delivered once a week. Helmick works with the Iowa City Library to deliver books to the Johnson County Jail and has worked at multiple libraries in Iowa to provide books to county jails. They said access to books is important for people who are incarcerated because reading can prepare them to successfully re-enter society. Literacy is a level up. Folks who have been placed into the criminal justice system and will most likely have a permanent record will face additional barriers when it comes to educational access and employment access. So providing literacy and information is crucial, Helmick says. Bookseller treats prisons like any other customer. Richard Hamilton owns Hamilton Books, one of the 2 approved book vendors for Iowa prisons. He said he doesn't believe that prisoners' access to books should be restricted. While Hamilton Books is an approved vendor for corrections departments in multiple states, Hamilton said the company didn't seek that designation and doesn't have a contract with any state department of corrections, including Iowa. He believes the company is often chosen by prison systems because, unlike many companies, Hamilton Books still prints a paper catalog and accepts paper checks. That makes it easier for inmates who have limited access to the internet to order books. In 2023, Hamilton Books sent an estimated 1,696 books to Iowa inmates in about 866 orders. Hamilton said the data was gathered by searching for Iowa prisons in the address lines of orders, but cautioned that it may not be entirely accurate. The company does not track data about prison book orders. Books and Things Warehouse, the other approved vendor for Iowa prisons, was not able to provide a similar statistic. We as a company support the right of every American, incarcerated or not, to buy and read the materials that they see fit, from whom they see fit, and we abhor censorship, Hamilton told the Gazette in an email. Ed, my uncle, and the former owner was selling books to inmates before I was alive, Hamilton said. We have always and will always treat them like any other customer as much as possible, even though they can represent some unique challenges. You are listening to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Tuesday, March 19th, 2024 on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now let's turn to today's obituaries. Dolores Boudreau Sellers, age 93, of Vinton, passed away peacefully on Sunday, March 17, 2024, at the Vinton Lutheran Home. Funeral services will be held at 11 o'clock a.m. Saturday, March 23, 2024, at Trinity Lutheran Church in Vinton, with Stephen Pruce officiating. Visitation will be held from 9:30 a.m. until service time at the church. Interment will be held at Evergreen Cemetery in Vinton. George Clive Cook, Marion. With sadness and joyful hearts, we wave goodbye to George Clive Cook, whose journey on this earth concluded peacefully on early Friday morning, February 23, 2024, at the Views of Marion. A celebration of life will be held at 1:30 p.m. on Sunday, March 24, 2024, at Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Marion, Iowa. Terry Dean Harris, 63, of Monmouth, passed away surrounded by his family on Friday, March 15, 2024, at Unity Point Health, St. Luke's Hospital, Cedar Rapids. Visitation will be Thursday, March 21st, 2024 from 3 p.m. to 8 p.m. at the Calkins Barn in Wyoming. Memorial service will be Friday, March 22, 2024 at 11 a.m. at the Calkins Barn in Wyoming. Burial will follow at the Monmouth Cemetery. Terry's family is requesting comfortable and casual attire to be worn for the services. Irene von Munster, 94, Anamosa, died Sunday, March 17, 2024, surrounded by her loving family. Funeral services will be held 11 o'clock Wednesday morning, March 20th, 2024, at the Gosch Funeral Home, Anamosa. Friends may call from 9 until service time at the funeral home. Emily I. Hines, Center Point. Emily I. Hines, 90, of Center Point, Iowa, passed away on March 17, 2024 at Summit Point Memory Care in Marion, Iowa. Visitation will be held from 4 to 7 p.m. on Thursday, March 21, 2024 at Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Center Point. Funeral services will begin at 10:30 a.m. on Friday, March 22, 2024 at First Christian Center Point Church, Center Point, with additional visitation 1 hour prior at the church. Burial will follow at the Center Point Cemetery. Teresa Stevens, Mentor, Ohio. Teresa Mary Grief Hollingsworth Stevens, 94, of Mentor, Ohio, formerly of Marion, passed away on Saturday, March 9, 2024. A funeral mass will be held on Friday, March 22, 2024, at 10:30 a.m. at St. Joseph Catholic Church in Marion, Iowa, with a visitation 1 hour prior. Private family interment at Mount Calvary Cemetery in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Center of Marion is assisting the family. Joan K. Oehler, O-E-H-L-E-R, 88, of Iowa City, lifelong resident of Corville and Iowa City, died Saturday, March 16, 2024, at the Lone Tree Health Center. Private family services will be held at St. Thomas More Catholic Church, with burial to follow at Oak Hill Cemetery in Coralville. In lieu of flowers, memorial donations may be made in her memory to the National Aphasia Association. William Bill Charles Stallman, 86, of Fairfax, died peacefully at his family farm on Saturday, March 16, 2024. Funeral mass, 10 a.m. on Thursday, March 21, at St. John Catholic Church, with Reverend Richmond Zoki officiating. Burial will be in St. Patrick's Cemetery, rural Fairfax. Visitation will be from 4 to 7 p.m. Wednesday at the Cedar Memorial Westside Chapel. Yolanda Rosnick, 62, of Tipton, passed away peacefully Sunday, March 17, 2024, at UIHC following a short illness. Visitation will be from 4 p.m. until 7 p.m. Friday, March 22, 2024, at Broche Chapel and the Ava Center in Cedar Rapids, located at 2121 Bowling Street Southwest. Celebration of Life service will be held 10:30 a.m. Saturday, March 23rd, 2024, at Broche Chapel. Burial will follow in Morse Cemetery. Raymond U. Schlamp, Anamosa. Raymond U. Schlamp, Private First Class, U.S. Army, died at the age of 28 on September 8, 1944, after being wounded in battle near Dornat, France, during World War II. A celebration of life will be held at 10 a.m. Saturday, April 6, 2024, at the Lawrence Community Center, Anamosa. Reverend Holly Naus will officiate. Military honors will be accorded by the United States Army following the service. Private burial will be in Linwood Cemetery, Dubuque, where he will be laid to rest next to his mother. Raymond was born in Leroy, Wisconsin on January 3, 1916, the son of John and Mabel Schlamp, serving in General George Patton's Third Army from November of 1941. He was wounded crossing the Moselle River near an area known as Horseshoe Woods. Due to heavy fighting, he was left behind when his unit retreated, and his remains were not located and identified following the battle. Raymond's family would like to thank the United States Army, which through DNA testing identified, recovered, and returned him to them. James Bubba Patrick Barr, 67, of Cedar Rapids, died on February 28, 2024, peacefully at his home. A celebration of life will be held at 1 p.m. Saturday, March 23, 2024, at Double Z's, 629 Ellis Boulevard Northwest. Tehan Funeral and Cremation are serving the family. Charlene Faye Kaufman Hansen, age 79, Cedar Rapids, passed away peacefully on March 16, 2024, surrounded by her family. A memorial service will be held at 4 p.m. on Friday, March 22, 2024, at Murdoch Linwood Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. A celebration of life will follow from 5 to 7 p.m. on Friday at the Legacy Center at Murdoch Linwood. Burial will take place at a later date in Vining National Cemetery in Vining, Iowa. On the Insight page, a guest column, William Lambers, "It's Our Tradition to Save Lives from Starvation." It was March 1945, and the Allied Expeditionary Force, under the command of General Dwight Eisenhower, was getting closer to defeating the Nazi Germany war machine. But there was another enemy threatening Europe, hunger. A report prepared by British officer Lieutenant General Sir Arthur E. Grasset detailed an emergency stockpile of food in the liberated section of the Netherlands. This food was meant for starving Dutch civilians in German-occupied areas as soon as liberation and access could be achieved. With famine conditions developing, this food would be a life-saving. Some of the supplies had already been used to feed Belgian war victims. The Allies had to replenish the food stockpile. Food from the U.S. was also sent to a British stockpile to be used for relief. It was this preparation by the Allies that saved lives at the end of World War II. Airdrops of food were followed by truck deliveries to feed millions throughout the Netherlands. This is one of the many great episodes in American history. This great American tradition goes back to the famine after World War I. In 1919, a New York Times headline read, "1 million children saved by America," detailing relief work in Poland. Even after the 1918 armistice, the struggle against hunger continued. As the American Relief Administration that carried out heroics in war-torn nations, feeding the hungry, the American people, including Congress, supported these relief efforts. In a Times article, Dr. Boris Bogan described how war victims in Poland were eating leaves and grass. Children did not know what bread was or even tasted milk. The American Relief Administration turned things around, setting up kitchens everywhere in Poland that fed malnourished children. The ARA also did heroic work in Latvia, bringing food to starving people, even as conflict continued among armed groups. One of the U.S. soldiers in the ARA even helped arrange a ceasefire in Latvia to allow humanitarian aid to be delivered. School lunch programs were set up to counter famine. We must carry on such noble missions in today's world as famine again looms. At this very moment, famine is threatening war victims in Gaza and Sudan. Burkina Faso and DR Congo and Afghanistan are also suffering severe hunger. In the Horn of Africa, it is drought that's creating the conditions for famine. There's a race against time in the African nation of Chad to get food pre-positioned ahead of the rainy season when roads flood. This is food for Sudanese war victims who have fled to Chad. But the UN World Food Program, WFP, does not have enough funding to get the food in place. That's one of the many tales of the tragic shortage of resources for the WFP and other relief agencies. The WFP has even been forced to reduce rations in some countries because of the lack of funds. That's why it's important for you to speak out against this injustice. Write to Congress and tell them to support humanitarian aid funding. Heroic efforts to fight hunger are only possible if they have support of the American public, leading Congress to take action. William Lambers is an author who partnered with the UN World Food Program on the book Ending World Hunger. In community letters, cameras must be on the ball in fast-tempo basketball. Viewing high-quality college basketball on TV is a wonderful diversion. The excitement of the games and the skill and artistry of players provide a needed escape from ugly politics and all the other disappointing news of the day and from the challenges of everyday life. It's too bad those in charge of the TV cameras often ruin the experience. Far too many times in fast-paced games, the director chooses to focus on a headshot of a player who has just made a play instead of allowing viewers to follow all the action on the floor, the reason we tune in. The Northland girls play an exciting, up-tempo, pressing game, and in one of their televised tournament games recently, another pointless headshot let the viewers miss an entire play sequence, including a foul. The camera cut to the action just as a player was shooting the resulting free throw. In the Iowa women's victories in the Big Ten championships, as in most televised games, there were any number of instances where action on the floor was missed in favor of a headshot. Fans of the game deserve better. Art Johnson, Edgewood. On the sports page, events of area interest, high school track, Washington, Kennedy, Jefferson at Kingston Stadium, 4 p.m., Marion in WAMAC indoor meeting at Grinnell, 2 p.m., Regina at River Valley Conference indoor at University of Dubuque, 4 p.m., college baseball, Upper Iowa at William Jewell, 3 p.m., women's lacrosse, Culver, Stockton at Cornell, 4:30 p.m. Bill would create legal immunity for pesticide manufacturers. Proposal exempts Chinese-owned companies by Caleb McCullough. Des Moines, Iowa. Iowa Senate lawmakers advanced for the second time a bill that would protect chemical manufacturers from lawsuits over failure to warn consumers about potential adverse health effects. The bill, Senate Study Bill 3188, was supported by Bayer, the manufacturer of the glyphosate-based herbicide Roundup. Bayer has been hit by lawsuits from individuals claiming it failed to warn consumers of the potential health risks of Roundup. The company has won some lawsuits against individuals alleging Roundup caused their cancer, but in other cases it has been found liable. Bayer spent more than $10 billion settling most pending claims in 2020. Under the bill, pesticide manufacturers would not be held liable for failing to warn consumers about adverse health effects in a way that exceeds the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency labeling requirements. The bill stipulates that the immunity would not apply to Chinese state-owned companies, singling out the massive agricultural and chemical company Syngenta. The bill was advanced by two Republicans on a three-member subcommittee Monday. It is eligible for a hearing in the full Senate Appropriations Committee. Bayer purchased the Roundup maker Monsanto in 2018. The company has multiple crop science plants in Iowa, including a plant in Muscatine that manufactures Roundup. Lobbyists for Bayer and major farm groups supported the bill and told lawmakers on Monday it would prevent unfounded lawsuits against the company, which creates a vital tool for farmers. Brad Epperly, a lobbyist for Bayer, said existing law and EPA regulations prevent Bayer from providing warnings that exceed EPA requirements. He said complying with EPA rules satisfies the duty to warn. Bayer has said it will seek a U.S. Supreme Court ruling to determine whether state-level duty-to-warn claims are preempted by federal law. A federal appeals court in February decided that those claims can be considered and allowed a lawsuit to go forward. We are not in a position where we can make that kind of warning, he said. There's no regulatory body in the entire world who finds this carcinogenic. Debate over Roundup health risk. Glyphosate-based herbicides like Roundup have received significant scrutiny over health claims. The EPA found glyphosate is not likely to be carcinogenic and has determined there are no risks of concern to human health. But a U.S. appeals court in 2022 vacated these findings for procedural reasons and required the agency to reconsider. A World Health Organization cancer agency found glyphosate in 2015 to be probably carcinogenic to humans, but European Union regulators have found that there was insufficient evidence for that categorization. Iowa environmental groups and some individuals objected to the bill, saying it would take away the ability of farmers to seek compensation when a company sells dangerous chemicals without proper warning. Alicia Vasto, the water program director for the Iowa Environmental Council, said the EPA has provided other chemicals that were later found to be dangerous, has approved other chemicals that were later found to be dangerous. This bill would prevent Iowa farmers and rural residents from seeking justice in the future, Vasto said. Time and time again, research has uncovered the dangers of pesticides after EPA has declared a product safe for use. Bill would exempt Chinese-owned companies. A similar bill made it partway through the lawmaking process this year before failing to pass out of either chamber before a deadline. The new bill adds language exempting Chinese-owned companies from immunity. A lobbyist for Syngenta, which is owned by the Chinese state-owned enterprise ChemChina, called the bill discriminatory. Kelly Paschke, representing Iowa trial lawyers, said the provision may be unconstitutional. Senator Mark Costello, Republican Imogene, who is a farmer, said he's concerned that if Bayer receives too many punitive court rulings related to Roundup, farmers could lose access to the product. Costello said consumers could still sue the company over specific harms, just not over duty to warn. If they find out they've been lying to us or misrepresenting things, or if it ends up that it really is dangerous and it's proven, then they can still sue under that statute, he said. Senator Bill Dotzler, a Democrat from Waterloo, voted against advancing the bill. He said he thinks there's evidence that Roundup contributes to instances of non-Hodgkin's lymphoma and other cancers. I think the label should say some kind of warning that this could affect your health, he said. West Liberty Foods laying off 260 workers. Turkey plant also temporarily suspends 401k employer contributions, by David Hoddle, Muscatine Journal, West Liberty. West Liberty Foods has announced it will lay off 260 workers, about a quarter of its workforce, at the turkey processing plant this year, beginning April 29th. The company also is temporarily suspending matching contributions to workers' 401k accounts in an effort to conserve cash. Dan Waters, the company's chief legal officer, said the West Liberty plant is discontinuing its ready-to-eat slicing operation and its second shift fabrication unit. The farmer-owned cooperative is moving some of the turkey slicing operation to its plant in Bolingbrook, Illinois, a Chicago suburb, the Des Moines Register reported Monday. Rapid growth in demand for West Liberty's ready-to-eat sandwiches produced at the Illinois plant is driving the move, the company told the Register. The news comes at the same time Tyson Foods has announced it will close its Perry pork processing plant, laying off nearly 1,300 workers in June. News that is figuring in Iowa lawmaker discussions about decreasing the rate companies must pay into the state's unemployment fund. As a resident of this community, the decision to reduce production capacity in West Liberty was difficult and painful, said Brandon Akin, president and CEO of West Liberty Foods. We value the contributions of all team members and deeply regret the need for layoffs. We are committed to connecting each affected person with new employment opportunities and support. West Liberty, with a population of around 4,000, became Iowa's first Latino-majority city in the 2010 census, with a 52% of its residents identifying as Hispanic or Latino. It has a Latino-majority city council and a number of Latinos working at West Liberty Foods. Waters said the plant, which has 865 workers, will provide on-site re-employment and support services for employees losing their jobs. The announcement said the layoffs will occur in stages in April, May, June, and November. The layoffs will mainly impact the West Liberty plant. The announcement follows a smaller round of layoffs in November 2023 when the company laid off 25 employees at the West Liberty plant, 17 in the Bolingbrook plant, and 12 in the Tremonton, Utah plant due to scaled back production. In October 2022, the company closed its Mount Pleasant plant. At the time, Waters said West Liberty Foods had to scale back production during the COVID-19 pandemic and the labor shortage that followed, allocating available products among existing customers and turning away new business. That left the business with more supervisory, clerical, and sales positions than were needed to support the reduced production. West Liberty Foods, founded by turkey growers in 1996, raises and slaughters about 5 million turkeys annually. Iowa ranks 7th in the nation in turkey production, and West Liberty Foods provides 40% of those turkeys. The West Liberty plant has a $55 million payroll, according to earlier reports. In regard to the company's 401k program, Waters said employees still are being allowed to make contributions to their retirement accounts. We don't know how long the employer match will be suspended, he said in an email to the Muscatine Journal. The timing will depend on our company's financial performance. Iowa City police investigate stabbing. Incident happened under Benton Street Bridge, by Emily Anderson, The Gazette, Iowa City. The Iowa City Police Department is investigating a stabbing that happened over the weekend. Yasarian Ulysses Williams, 47, of Iowa City, has been charged with willful injury causing serious injury in relation to the stabbing, which happened at 1:20 p.m. Saturday under the Benton Street Bridge, according to the news release from the police department. Williams was arguing with another person before stabbing him in the chest, shoving him into the river, and telling him he was going to die, according to a criminal complaint against Williams. The victim had emergency surgery at University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics and is in critical condition, the complaint states. The identity of the victim has not been released. Williams is being held in Johnson County Jail on a cash-only $10,000 bond. Police released a photo Monday of a potential witness and asked for the public's help in identifying him. As of 3:30 p.m. Monday, the witness was identified and no additional information was available. Lawsuit over Pleasant Valley School Board recount dismissed. Judge, plaintiff should have filed an election contest, by William Morris. A Scott County candidate's lawsuit challenged the result of her unsuccessful 2023 school board bid has been dismissed after the judge found she failed to file an election challenge as laid out by state law. Tracy Rivera, an incumbent member of the Pleasant Valley School Board, ran as a write-in candidate due to a problem with her nominating petition and was declared the loser on election day by 6 votes. In subsequent recount, the 3-member panel found the race was a dead tie. After one member objected that the panel had counted votes that were ineligible because they were improperly marked, the Scott County Board of Supervisors rejected the recount's finding, leaving opposing candidate Jameson Smith the victor. The Iowa Secretary of State's office later admonished the board for including the incorrect ballots. Rivera sued the county, arguing that the supervisors did not have discretion to reject a lawful recount and the race should have been decided by coin flip. The county and Smith, who filed to intervene in the case, both asked the court to dismiss Rivera's lawsuit. In an order Wednesday, Judge Mark Fowler agreed. Fowler ruled that the type of relief Rivera sought, compelling the county board to take some action, is only available for plaintiffs who have no other legal avenue to turn to. Fowler said Iowa law allows a candidate to initiate a proceeding known as an election contest within 20 days, and Rivera did not do so. Because she did not avail herself to another plain, speedy, and adequate remedy of the law, Rivera's petition must be dismissed, Fowler wrote. An attorney with the firm representing Rivera said in a statement they were very disappointed by the order and that the Scott County Board of Supervisors clearly failed to fulfill their legal duty to accept the findings of the recount board. Attorney Alan Ostergren, a frequent litigator in Iowa election cases who represented Smith, said in an email the judge reached the right result and criticized the faulty recount process that precipitated the lawsuit. If the recount board had listened to the legal advice it was given, it would have never counted invalid write-in votes in the first place, he said. That is why the Secretary of State issued an infraction to the 2 members of the board. Their refusal to listen ended up creating a huge mess. Thankfully, the court's decision today goes a long way towards cleaning it up. And that does it for today's reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Tuesday, March 19th, 2024. I'm your reader, Denise. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. Thanks for listening. Thank you.
Are you among the millions of Americans living with chronic pain? If so, you may think prescription opioids are the solution. The truth is, the benefits of opioids are limited. Opioids only mask the pain. Opioids also come with serious side effects, ranging from nausea to withdrawal symptoms to overdose. As many as 25% of people who are prescribed opioids struggle with addiction. And those who are addicted to opioids are 40 times more likely to move on to heroin. No one wants to live in pain, but no one should put their health at risk to be pain-free. There is another choice, physical therapy. Physical therapists treat pain through movement and exercise, no warning labels required, and you get to be an active participant in your care. Choose to treat your pain safely. Choose physical therapy. Visit moveforwardpt.com to find a physical therapist near you. This public service announcement is brought to you by the American Physical Therapy Association.